Well, let's read the happy ending right at the end of chapter 4. Chapter 4, verse 13. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. Then he went to her, and the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. The women said to Naomi, "Praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a kinsman redeemer. May he become famous throughout Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age, for your daughter-in-law, who loves you, and who is better to you than seven sons, has given him birth." Then Naomi took the child, laid him in her lap, and cared for him. The women living there said, "Naomi has a son," and they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. Here's a poem about love, well, love of a sort. The act of love lies somewhere between the belly and the mind. I lost the love some time ago. Now I've only the act to grind. Brought her back from a party. Don't bother swapping names. Identity's not needed when you're only playing games. High on bedroom darkness, we endure the pantomime. Ships that go bump in the night, run aground on the sands of time. Saved in the nick of dawn, it's cornflakes and then goodbye, another notch on the headboard, another day wondering why. The act of love lies somewhere between the belly and the mind. I lost the love some time ago. Now I have only the act to grind. Few cultures have bandied the word love around more freely than ours, yet as those lines from Roger McGough's poem indicate, an enormous number of people do experience great difficulty in finding the quality of interpersonal relationship they really seek in love. The man in that poem, for instance, tells us he had found love elusive and had been forced to substitute empty sex in its place. And you know as well as I do, there are many others in our society today who make that same unsatisfactory exchange. Eric Fromm, in his book The Act of Loving, blames it all on the economic system. It's capitalism, he says, which has rendered real love impossible by its cultivation of self-interest. Men and women do not really love one another anymore. They use one another for the fulfillment of their individual needs. It's a kind of commercial contract. Just as a car owner uses a mechanic to service his car, so men and women use each other. Other sociologists have drawn attention to the role which the eroticization of society by the media has played. 40 years ago, the publication of D.H. Lawrence's novel Lady Chatterley's Lover was sufficiently scandalous to merit a high court action under the Obscene Publications Act. Now we have softcore pornography, thinly disguised as sex education videos, on sale at Woolworths. We have girly magazines that would once have only been available in some curtain dive in Soho, freely available at the newsagent on the corner. And our advertisers seem incapable of marketing even so mundane a commodity as a bar of chocolate without turning it into some object of phallic fantasy. Expectations of sexual athleticism in one's partner and of sexual ecstasy in oneself have been raised to dizzying heights by this onslaught of eroticism. I suspect that never since the days of the Roman Empire has the general level of sexual arousal in society been so high. And in such a world, it isn't surprising if the distinction between love and lust gets rather blurred. Do you know this poem by Steve Turner? "Tonight we will fake love together. You, my love, possess all the essential qualities as listed by Playboy. You will last me as long as 2 weeks, or until such a time as your face and figure go out of fashion. I will hold you close to my Hollywood standard body, the smell of which has been approved by my 10 best friends and a representative of Lifebuoy. I will prop my paperback Kama Sutra on the dressing table, and like programmed seals, we will perform. And like human beings, we will grow tired of our artificially sweetened, diluted, and ready-to-drink love affairs. Tonight we will fake love. The sarcasm is heavy, but it's hardly unjustified, is it? Turner speaks for a great many people today whose dreams of loving relationships lie shattered, invariably ending up as empty and unsatisfying shams, faking love rather than making it. Is it capitalism that is to blame with its proliferation of shallow relationships? Is it our media and their insatiably sex-mad antics? One sociological study that some of you may have heard me mention before, which I think sheds an enormous amount of light on this important social trend in our midst, was published in the 80s entitled The Habits of the Heart. A small group of sociologists worked at Berkeley University in California to produce this study, which is a social analysis of people's attitudes towards social commitments, the tension between individual freedom and social commitment. That's really the theme of the whole book. And one of the most important findings concerned people's attitudes towards feelings. What the sociologists who compiled this book discovered was that people with older, more traditional ideas took the view that feelings should always take second place to duty. Hence, a high value was placed by such people on virtues like self-control and self-denial and self-discipline and self-sacrifice. Marital love was seen on this view fundamentally as a commitment of the will, which one ought to honour irrespective of whether one's feelings about it were always good or bad. But the researchers discovered that that traditional attitude was very rapidly being displaced in modern society by a different attitude, which they characterized the therapeutic attitude. On this view, feelings take priority over everything else. The important virtues are not those which restrain the expression of the self, but those which liberate it. Honesty, openness, these are what count. Not self-discipline or self-denial or self-control or self-sacrifice, but rather self-fulfillment, self-realization, self-acceptance, self-actualization. These are the buzzwords of the therapeutic attitude. The spontaneous sharing of feelings between authentic, expressive individuals. This is the therapeutic ideal of love. And long-term commitment does not necessarily feature in such a relationship at all. According to the therapeutic attitude, if my emotional needs are not being met by my partner, I am entitled to sever the relationship. The therapeutic attitude denies all forms of social obligation or duty, replacing them with the ideals of open and honest communication instead. The only thing a therapeutically liberated lover owes to his or her partner is to share his or her feelings fully. Emotional independence and self-sufficiency are the goal. And a personal relationship is simply seen as a device for achieving this essentially individualistic goal. Now, I'm not saying that the therapeutic attitude is all bad. Undoubtedly, it does do some a great service by helping them to get in touch with their own wants and needs and emancipating them from the artificial constraints of cramping social roles, guilt-inducing manipulations by other people. One has seen enough in pastoral situations to recognize that to make a martyr of oneself is not always the right and Christian thing to do. But it has to be said that carried to an extreme, this kind of therapeutic attitude is desperately corrosive of loving relationships. I found a huge number of bells ringing in my own ears as I studied that book. No doubt capitalism, by its endorsement of self-interest, has prepared the ground for such a new attitude. And no doubt the media, in its preoccupation with erotic images, has encouraged and exploited it. But the root of our 20th century decay in loving interpersonal relationships between the sexes is not economic or erotic. It is moral. We have actually changed the goalposts in the last half a century. We have redefined the meaning of the word love. It is no longer a sacrificial commitment to another person. Love is now an intensity of feeling within myself. That change has come about very subtly, but it is now almost, I think, universal. The act of love lies somewhere between the belly and the mind, my belly and my mind. Little wonder that such love feels uncontrollably volatile and elusive. I lost it some time ago, says the poet. Now I am left only with the act to grind. Well, the Book of Ruth is surely all about the difference which interpersonal commitment can make to our experience of the meaning of love. It's possible, says this book, to rediscover that blend of intimacy and security which only real committed love can provide. The Book of Ruth encourages us to believe in that love. Old-fashioned though it may seem. As we've said repeatedly, the Book of Ruth is set in the time of the judges. That too, significantly, was a period when the old moral order was disintegrating into anarchy. The author of the Book of Judges himself points out that everybody did what they wanted to do. It was a thoroughly individualistic, hedonistic kind of society that was developing, with the result that acts of sexual brutality and criminal violence were commonplace. But Ruth, you see, like a candle in the darkness, offers us a touching beacon of hope in that very society where the law of the jungle so generally prevailed. I suspect, even in its own day, that Ruth was an old-fashioned book. It is a classic historical romance. It offers its reader an affirmation of those traditional values of love. Yet there's nothing sentimental about the story, is there? This story is meant to convince us that love is a commitment, a sacrificial commitment to somebody else. It's about loyalty and duty and the cost which loyalty and duty impose. It's about putting the needs of other people above our own. It's about the way that God achieves his purposes in history through insignificant little people who trust him enough to take the risks which such sacrificial, committed love demands. Now, if you were here last week, we saw the first example of this kind of love, didn't we? In chapter 1, as our author points out to us that Ruth, contrary to all good sense and to her own best interests, commits herself in love to her widowed mother-in-law, Naomi. Rather than leave this older woman bereft, Ruth abandons her own country of Moab and accompanies Naomi to Judah. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. She deliberately echoes the covenant vow of Jehovah to Israel in her own covenant vow to Naomi. Such a covenant relationship is what real love is all about. If Ruth had only been interested in her own self-fulfillment, she would have ditched Naomi and gone in search of her husband from among her own people. But no, she was part of Naomi's family, one of the few members of that family left alive, and she was determined to put that loyalty first. Well, as if to reinforce that same lesson, at the end of the book, in chapter 3 and 4, our author presents us with a second example of it. Only this time, while Ruth is the catalyst, it is somebody else who this time must demonstrate that demands of such committed covenant love. A man, this time. Boaz. Come back to that verse with which we ended our first study, verse 9 of chapter 3. Who are you? He asked. I'm your servant, Ruth, she said. Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a kinsman redeemer. Now, in order to make sense of these last two chapters of Ruth and the climax of the story which they contain, we need to learn a little about the legal provisions which Old Testament law made for widows. There were two pieces of legislation which were of particular relevance. The first was the law of so-called levirate marriage, which I alluded to earlier. You can read more fully about it in Deuteronomy 25 if you're interested. Basically, this law said that there was an obligation on the part of a dead man's brother to take his brother's widow into his own household. And if she had no children, to marry her and to have a child by her so that his brother would have an heir to inherit that deceased brother's estate. Now, this probably seems to us a rather bizarre arrangement. But if you think about it, it did solve an immensely important social problem. Whose responsibility was it to care for a widow? What the law of levirate marriage said was that that responsibility fell not on the widow's parental family, as we probably would naturally assume in our culture, but on her marital family, and in particular, on her brother-in-law. That's what the law said. The second piece of legislation, which is relevant to this whole question of caring for widows and the Book of Ruth, is the law of redemption. You find that expounded in detail in Leviticus chapter 25. This dealt not just with widows, actually, but with any family member who fell on hard times. Maybe they fell into debt and had to sell their family land. Maybe the debt was so large they had to sell themselves into slavery, too. In such a situation, the law said a family member must take upon themselves the role of kinsman redeemer, a technical term in Hebrew. This kinsman redeemer should pay off the person's debts, redeeming both their property and their freedom. Now, if the law of levirate marriage seems bizarre to us, I suspect this law of redemption must seem extraordinarily generous. Redemption could involve a very considerable sum of money. Could the law really require a relative to pay out such a huge sum for the sake of a relative who'd fallen on hard times? Well, you see, it's precisely because the Old Testament sees love as primarily commitment, duty to another person, to a relationship, rather than a spontaneous feeling in myself, that it could require such acts of personal sacrifice. A man owed such sacrificial loyalty to his family. The law did not allow him to think in our modern categories of self-centered individualism. It cultivated by its very institutions this sense of solidarity in relationship. Anyway, to return to our story, what did these two pieces of ancient legislation mean for Ruth and her mother-in-law, Naomi? The answer is, as far as they could tell on their return to Judah, they didn't mean very much. For a start, as you've already said, this was the period of the judges. And one suspects that in the time of the judges, obedience to costly covenant law, the law of Moses, was rare. Do others before they do you, was the popular philosophy of the streets in those days. Widows, one suspects, stood more chance of being raped than redeemed in the lawless society of 11th century BC Bethlehem. But more than that, Naomi's domestic tragedy had been so severe that it had left her with no close male relatives anyway who could fulfill the moral obligation towards her which these laws required. And her daughter-in-law was even in an even weaker position. It's quite clear that that one's responsibility to do something for an impoverished widow diminished as one's distance from one's kinship distance from the family increased. A brother-in-law was required by law to do something for the wife, the widow of his dead brother. But it was unreasonable and unrealistic to expect distant relatives to feel the same degree of moral obligation. But in Naomi's case, distant relatives was all she seems to have had. in that respect, the description of Boaz in chapter 2, verse 20, as a close relative, I think is a misleading translation. In my view, the Hebrew simply implies that he was the next relative. Or as it turns out, the next but one relative. In other words, the nearest or one of the nearest relatives she'd got. But that doesn't necessarily imply that he was anything nearer than a second cousin thrice removed. Indeed, the whole point of chapters 3 and 4 of this story, and the plot hinges on this, is that Boaz was so distant a relative that any action on his part was purely voluntary. There was no social expectation upon him to intervene in Naomi's affairs at all. Yet he did. And that, of course, is precisely what Ruth's urgent appeal to him in 3 verse 9 is all about. Spread the corner of your garment on me. That's a euphemistic proposal of marriage. Why? Since you are a kinsman redeemer. In other words, I'm a widow. The law says my brother-in-law should marry me and deliver me from the helplessness and hopelessness of my position in this male-dominated society. But I haven't got a brother-in-law, Boaz. I can only then appeal to you, as one of the nearest relatives I've got, to assume this role of kinsman redeemer for me. Spread the corner of your garment over me. Marry me. Now, as we said earlier, it was a phenomenally risky initiative on Ruth's part. She was gambling not just with her pride, but with her virtue. Many a man would have told her to get lost. Worse still, many a man would have taken sexual advantage of her in this situation. But Boaz, as our author has already told us, was a noble and gentlemanly chap. And it's quite clear he recognized a similar moral caliber in Ruth. See how he goes on in verse 10. The Lord bless you, my daughter, he replied. This kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier. You have not run after the younger men, whether rich or poor. And now, my daughter, don't be afraid. I will do for you all you ask. All my fellow townsmen know that you are a woman of noble character. Although it is true that I am near of kin, there is a kinsman redeemer nearer than I. Stay here for the night, and in the morning, if he wants to redeem, good, let him redeem. But if he's not willing, as surely as the Lord lives, I will do it. Lie here until morning. It's important to understand the import of these words. Many a young widow in Ruth's position would have, to use Boaz's phrase in verse 10, run after younger men. She had no dowry to offer, and she was a foreigner. Both those things counted against her very seriously in the marriage stakes. But she was clearly attractive and shrewd. So she could easily have frequented the ancient equivalent of a singles bar and sought to entice some oversexed young man with little experience but plenty of cash into a compromising situation from which the only escape would be matrimony. Such things happen today, and you can be sure they happened then. And many a young woman in Ruth's situation would have felt compelled to use such unscrupulous tactics to secure her future. But Ruth had not followed that course of action, commonly expected though it clearly was. She might thereby have secured a very comfortable position for herself. But you see, if she had, quite apart from the moral implications of acting that way, if she had followed that route, it would have left Naomi high and dry. For any young gigolo she found that way would have no responsibility at all towards Naomi. Rather than, true to the commitment to the promise she had made, Ruth refused to desert her mother-in-law and look for some young man of her own. Instead, she had deliberately offered herself to Boaz, a man whom we know was old enough to be her father, but he was a potential kinsman redeemer. And if he assumed that legal responsibility of kinsman redeemer, then both Ruth and Naomi's future would be secured as a result. That, you see, is what Boaz means when he says, this kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier. He's referring to her kindness to Naomi, not to him. He's acknowledging that this relationship which Ruth is offering him is in part, at any rate, a consequence of the loyal love she has pledged to his cousin Elimelech's widow. And he's a wise enough man and a humble enough man to recognize that a woman who understands love in that sacrificial and committed way is going to make a most outstanding wife. Ruth is indeed a woman of noble character. He says people had already begun to recognize that, but Boaz is confident they haven't yet seen half. However, the story's not over yet, is it? There is a legal problem, a predicament to be overcome. And it could yet torpedo that happy ending. For the role of kinsman redeemer followed a strict pecking order, and Boaz, we discover now, was only second in line. It would take some delicate negotiations to oust his predecessor without having to offer any sweeteners. On no account must word get out that Boaz actually fancies Ruth and wants to marry her. If his rival were to sense some romantic interest in the arrangement, he would be sure to exploit the situation for his own financial advantage. Now, their meeting then must be kept secret, verse 14. So she lay at his feet until morning, but got up before anybody could be recognized. And he said, "Don't let it be known that a woman came to the threshing floor." Now, there are some commentators who insist that Boaz's invitation to Ruth to stay the night must imply that sexual intercourse took place between them. The text, it seems to me, goes quite out of the way to insist that no such union took place at all. She lay at his feet, we're told, an expression which, as we noted earlier, could be interpreted more than one way, and which certainly implies some measure of physical intimacy. But I find no evidence in the Old Testament that that phrase implies any kind of actual sexual activity. He tells her to wait till dawn, undoubtedly, because there is a danger involved in young women being out alone in the darkness, and because the matter must be kept secret, he cannot accompany her back to her home. Boaz is not yet Ruth's husband, though. Indeed, it may yet prove impossible for him to become her husband. And there's no way he would risk her honor or his own by a foolish act of impatience. An opportunity, perhaps, here for young couples to ponder on the necessary discretion of premarital life. No matter how sure you are about your intention to marry, things can go wrong. Sometimes do go wrong. Engagements do break. So the path of prudence is, like Boaz and Ruth, to make the covenant legal and public before you seal it irrevocably in physical union. Of course, there will be moments of private intimacy, of great tenderness, in that premarital period. But if we're wise, like Boaz, we will wait till the second ring is on the finger. Well, at the end of chapter 3, our author is holding us in suspense. Everybody else in Bethlehem is asleep, but Naomi isn't, of course. Verse 16. When Ruth comes to her mother-in-law, Naomi asks, "How did it go, my daughter?" Or literally, "Who are you?" That's what the Hebrew says. I think it's as if to say, "Are you Mrs. Boaz or not yet?" And on receiving Ruth's report, she with us waits with bated breath to see how Boaz is going to engineer the necessary legal coup to make a marriage to Ruth possible. But in chapter 4, good old Boaz doesn't disappoint us, does he? You know the story, I'm sure. A carefully planned but apparently accidental meeting with the other relative in question provides him with the opportunity he needs for a public hearing of the case before the elders. What this poor guy thinks is going to be a little private tete-a-tete suddenly turns into be a major court case with all the elders surrounding him. Wisely, Boaz doesn't mention Ruth at all. He treats it all as a question of property only. Elimelech had held title to some land. By Israelite law, that land passed to the next of kin, which was this unnamed relative. However, there was Naomi to consider. Any relative who took possession of Elimelech's land would be morally bound to provide for the widow too. It's in that sense, I suspect, that Boaz speaks of Naomi selling the land. Not that the freehold was hers to dispose of, because by Israelite law it wasn't, but in the sense that any kinsman who wanted to claim that land would have to agree to a financial settlement that would provide for her needs or forfeit his claim to the land. Now, the kinsman at first considers this a bargain, because Naomi is, after all, old, and she has no children. So, verse 4, he says, I will redeem it. The financial needs of Naomi would be slim, and the property in question, therefore, would make a nice addition to his estate. But that's when Boaz drops his bombshell, verse 5. Then Boaz says, on the day you buy the land from Naomi and from Ruth the Moabitess, you acquire the dead man's widow in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property. In other words, says Boaz, there are two laws to consider here, not just one. If you're going to fulfill the role of kinsman redeemer as regards Elimelech's property, you surely must take on board the legal responsibility of levirate marriage too. And according to that law, you are duty-bound to raise up an heir to Elimelech. And whilst Naomi may be past childbearing age, the widow of Elimelech's son is not. So argues Boaz before the elders. If you want his property, you must wed Ruth too. But this, as Boaz clearly anticipated, the anonymous kinsman is not willing to do. Verse 6. At this, the kinsman redeemer said, then I cannot redeem it, because I might endanger my own estate. Now, he may be simply saying there that the financial burden of two widows was more than he could reasonably afford. It will bankrupt me. Or he might be anticipating problems ahead between his own family and any sons he might give Ruth. For arguments about title to property were all too common in these lawless days, one suspects, and wise men probably organized their affairs so as to avoid them. Or it is just possible there's an element of superstition revealed in this remark. In Genesis 38, you know, there's an interesting story which is not without some parallel to this story of Ruth. And there's a specific allusion to it, actually, in verse 12 of Ruth 4, the story of Tamar, Judah's daughter-in-law, who, like Ruth, was also widowed young. And Judah would not give his son to Tamar, according to the levirate law, because he superstitiously thought that there might be a curse on the woman, and that he would lose that son too. Maybe something like this is going through our kinsman's head. Who's to say there isn't a jinx on Ruth? After all the men in her family seem to die in mysterious circumstances. Maybe there's some lethal pagan magic attached to her. She is a Moabitess after all. Well, for whatever reason, the kinsman is unwilling to take on board the legal responsibility of kinsman redeemer and levirate marriage. And so he says to Boaz, I'm unable to redeem it. You redeem it for yourself. And Boaz does. I wonder if you notice here that there is a strange echo in this situation with the situation that prevailed in chapter 1. There it was Ruth and Orpah, you remember, who were faced with a choice. Stay with Naomi or go back to Moab. Orpah, though she felt the pull of family duty to some extent, found the personal cost involved of staying with Naomi more than she was prepared to pay. So she waved Naomi goodbye. She had the right to do that. There's no blame attached to her. The cost of covenant love was just a little bit too much for her. Ruth, on the other hand, was willing to go the extra mile. She stayed. Love for her meant sacrificial commitment. Well, now a rather similar choice faces these two men. But once again, only one of them is prepared to accept the sacrificial responsibility which covenant love, as defined in God's law, demanded. The other finds the cost too much. I can't redeem, he says. I will endanger my own estate if I do. You redeem it for yourself. So Boaz does. Then Boaz announced to the elders and all the people, today you are witnesses that I have bought from Naomi all the property of Elimelech, Chilion, and Mahlon. I have also acquired Ruth, the Moabitess, Mahlon's widow, as my wife, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property, so that his name will not disappear from among his family or from the town records. Today you are witnesses. And then the elders and all those at the gate said, we are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you have standing in Ephrathah and may be famous in Bethlehem. Through the offspring the Lord gives you by this young woman, may your family be like that of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. And so it is that Naomi, who you remember, came back empty from Moab, finds herself at the end of this story with her lap full, not just of corn, but full with a grandson she can be proud of in her old age. Remember what she says? Praise be to the Lord, verse 14, who this day has not left you without a kinsman redeemer. May he become famous throughout Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. For your daughter-in-law who loves you, and who is better to you than seven sons, has given him birth. Well, what does our author want us to learn from this charming and beautifully narrated story? Let me, in conclusion, just review the whole story and pull out for you a number of interwoven threads, which it seems to me this story is meant to drive home to us. One theme, I think, which our author clearly intends to communicate is the role of women in God's purposes. That phrase, a woman of noble character, in 3 verse 11, is exactly the same phrase we come across, of course, in Proverbs 31, describing the wife, the noble wife. Depending on when you think the story of Ruth was written, it may very well be a quote, one way or the other. Ancient Israel, of course, was an intensely patriarchalist society, and never more so than in the period of the Judges, when violent male machismo was really the established order of the day. And yet here in this story, we are presented with a woman of independence and self-reliance and courage. True, she uses her feminine wiles, but never in any way that is morally unscrupulous, it seems to me. She does not seek to manipulate Boaz or to entrap him in an unfair way. She does not seduce him or threaten to publicly embarrass him. Now, the interesting thing about Ruth is that she takes initiative in finding a husband for herself, yet she never compromises her essential femininity in doing so. She doesn't usurp the man's role. On the contrary, she appeals to Boaz to fulfill his special masculine responsibility as leader in the affair. She doesn't try to compete with the man. Rather, she strengthens his arm in doing what deep down he knew he ought to do and what deep down he knew perhaps he wanted to do. Now, I don't want to labor this point, but in the current foment about gender, there does seem to be here a model which all of us, whether men or women, could profitably consider. Ruth is most certainly not a passive doormat under a man's feet. But neither is she an aggressive rival to his ego. She doesn't emasculate him by her feminist ambition. She empowers him by the strong, supportive moral example of her love. I suspect it may be true that women generally understand covenant love and its sacrifices better than men do. Certainly, I think that is probably true in a capitalist society where men are trained to be rivals and competitors. And I suspect I'm speaking for most men here when I say that this kind of quality, strong, supportive, moral example of love, is what we most need and most long for in a wife. Is that really a capitulation to sexist stereotypes to say a thing like that? Is Ruth, for all her courage and nobility, still in this story a victim of oppressive patriarchalism in her culture? Or does the Bible intend her to be a model of godly femininity for all time? I merely asked the question. I wouldn't dare to answer it. The second strand that flows through this whole story, which I'm quite sure there's profit in considering, is the role of the family in social welfare. Notice again that word kinsman-redeemer that occurs so many times. Both those ancient laws we have mentioned, the law of levirate marriage and the law of redemption, which undergird this story, center on the role of kinship in social welfare. Where our society, at least in recent years, by its statutes and welfare programs, has so often had the effect of removing responsibility from the family, biblical law, by the very structure of its welfare provisions, places responsibility on the family to care for its own. And that in turn, of course, meant that people had an enormous economic interest in maintaining strong family connections. Now, in days when we are beginning to realize the huge tax cost of a welfare system in a community where family breakdown is becoming almost the norm, this, it seems to me, has considerable relevance for our legislators. They could profitably reflect on the way in which Old Testament law structured itself in this regard. It's quite pointless to make platitudes about the importance of family life if we are at the same time stripping the family of its economic and social functions. If we generate a situation in which both parents have to work in order to survive financially, we shall have neglected children. And the statistics of youth crime will escalate as a result. If we generate a situation in which families don't have room to accommodate their elderly relatives at home, we shall have lonely old people and beds occupied in the hospital which we cannot release. And we shall have to build geriatric homes and finance them. If we generate a situation in which adultery is seen as fun and divorce is unpenalized in the courts, we shall have ever-increasing numbers of fatherless children and the emotional debris that results. Look at any society you like and you will discover the family is only strong when it is supported by the economic and legal structure of that society. Mere sexual attraction, mere family affection is not a reliable enough social adhesive on its own to protect family life. The Bible has a lot of wisdom for our legislators in this respect. The third strand that flows through this story that we ought to note is the openness of God's heart to people of all races. I don't know if it struck you how often the adjective Moabites is attached to Ruth's name in this story. Almost every time her name is mentioned, it is Ruth the Moabites. Quite redundant and unnecessary after the first mention of where she comes from. But our author, you see, alludes to her ethnic origin so repeatedly in order to warn his audience not to interpret the covenant of God chauvinistically. The Jews were always prone to do this. Aren't we the chosen nation? Ethnocentricity, racist prejudice was always a danger for them. But throughout the Old Testament, there's this strong strand of protest against any kind of xenophobic tendency. Abraham's promise is that he will be the means of blessing to all the nations. And Ruth is a classic example of that. She is a Moabite by birth. But spiritually, she is a believer in the God of Abraham. And the thrust of our story is that as such, she has as much title to the protection of God's law and to acceptance among God's people as any native-born Jewess. Now, as Christians, of course, we shouldn't need to be told things like that, should we? Though I suspect we do. Eyebrows would no doubt have been raised in Bethlehem at the news that Boaz was marrying a woman of Moab. You can see the scandal on the street corners as that news got gibbered around. I wonder how other members of his family felt about the move. He goes, you know as well as I do, no matter how liberal we are in theory, no matter how outspokenly anti-racist we are, no matter if we even buy The Guardian daily, it's a different matter when it is our son who wants to marry the black girl, isn't it? Now learn from the story of Ruth that God is colorblind. He really means it when he says he looks on the heart. Therefore, so should we. But most of all, this is a story about love. It's a story about the real meaning of love. It's a story designed to deprogram us from our selfish, individualistic, therapeutic attitude towards love. It's a story that's meant to encourage us to believe that if we really want to know what love means in its fullest and richest form, we must be willing for commitment and sacrifice as the price of love. Kenneth Clark, in his book Civilization, comments, "We can destroy ourselves by cynicism as well as by bombs." That's a shrewd observation. It's all too easy when evil is in the ascendant to become demoralized and pessimistic, isn't it? Many an idealistic young person surrenders to disillusionment and doubt in midlife under the pressure of a world where goodness seems so often to lose out. And in some respects, that's exactly the danger represented by Naomi in the story. She is a woman of faith, but she is reduced by the devastating impact of family bereavement to a state of stubborn resentment. "Don't call me Naomi," she says at the end of chapter 1. "Call me Mara. The Almighty has made my life bitter." Naomi there articulates, doesn't she, the complaint of every believer who finds themselves the innocent victim of God's judgment on this fallen world. How can you go on believing in the love of God when things like this happen, we ask? The world is too miserable, too pain-ridden, too tragic for faith in any God to survive except a God of ruthless and callous indifference. But Naomi discovers that her cynicism is misplaced. God is love. And at the end of the day, his love will be victorious. How was that faith restored to her? As the result of her personally experiencing the human love of Ruth. That's how. That's how her faith in the covenant love of the God of Israel was restored. That's how her soul was saved. Because another human being demonstrated such love to her. And if we are going to avoid the perils of cynicism in this broken world of ours, that is how we too must find our faith sustained and how we must seek to sustain the faith of others. In this turbulent period of the judges, it was not the physical heroism of Samson's strength that carried forward the eternal purpose of God. It was the moral heroism of Ruth's love. How does chapter 4 end again? Naomi has a son. They named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. So Bethlehem, that little town where it had all happened, would become famous. Not as in the past for pillage and rape, but as the birthplace of kings. And one day, 1,000 years on, the King of Kings himself would be born there. And Ruth would find special mention in his genealogy in Matthew 1. Covenant love, then. Sacrificial love. Redemptive love. Do we really believe in such love? A love which is not merely the intensity of feeling located in some region between the brain and the groin, but which is a moral commitment to another person. And if we want to know where, of course, the real act of love is to be located in Roger McGough's poem, we must look to a cross, mustn't we? Where God himself demonstrated the extremity to which covenant love will go in its commitment and sacrifice, in its determination to redeem the loved one.